You know, one of the questions that as a pastor I get asked more than probably any other is one that maybe you've asked or that you showed up today with because somebody told you that we were going to be talking about this. And that question is this: who actually goes to heaven? Who actually makes it in? If the heaven is a thing, if it's a place where good people go or God is, who actually gets to make it there? And one version of that question that I get asked a lot has to do with this. People will say, hey, don't tell anybody, Jason, but will my dog go to heaven? And it feels like this kind of silly, maybe superficial thing. But I want to tell you, I don't think it is. I think the question when someone says, hey, is Sparky gonna leap across the gold streets and join me when I get to heaven? What they're actually getting to is just how good is God? Because see, we're told that God gives every good gift, everything that we have in life for our enjoyment and for our ability to reflect back to him worship and praise. And so even things like pets, and some of you, you love your pets. And they have brought you so much joy, and you recognize that as God. I think, and like, this is not in the Bible, okay? But I think it is just like God in his extravagant grace and goodness for you to show up into heaven and for Sparky to be there waiting for you. Yeah, I think dogs go to heaven. That's what I'm saying. Now, cats, totally different story. But look, they believe they're already in heaven. They think they're God. So, like, it's not that bad for them. But underneath the question of, like, the pets and goodness is really, it's even another question. And that is this. It's how good is good enough? Because what we often will say is, like, yeah, but what about my, you know, my Muslim friend? He's, like, he's super moral and he's really integrous and he's devout. Are you telling me that he doesn't go to heaven? Or like my friend who's just an absolute, you know, agnostic or atheist, and they're a better dad than me, a better husband than me. They're just a better human than me. And is he going to make it into heaven? There's this belief that we have that somehow there is like a formula that says like you're this good and that allows you or it should force God to let you be with him in all of his goodness. And what I want to show you over the next few minutes is why the standard of good just doesn't cut it. And you actually know this. I'm going to show you because you already believe this is true, but then we got to figure out what do we do with it if good is just not good enough. At the root of it is us evaluating God's standard of fairness. There's a pastor in the East Coast named Andy Stanley who talked about this once, and he used some great illustrations that I think are really helpful for me and you to get it. So let me tell you this. Good is not a great standard because good changes over time, right? The definition of good is different in different generations, in different cultures, different parts of the world. So, like, let me ask you this. How many of you think that it is good and we should treat women equally, with equal value, dignity, and worth, that is a good thing? Raise your hand. There's some of you literally not raising your hands. I may have to rework my sermon. I'm not sure if you're getting in. Right? We believe that that's a good thing. But before about 1850, people didn't think that was a good thing. Your woman was your property. Maybe they were your helper. But they were not of equal standing and value. And that's not just in America. That's like in the world. So, all right, all the men before 1850 don't get into heaven. We're narrowing. Then how about this? How many of you would say that it is good to not be an owner of a person? That, like, to enslave someone, that is a bad thing, right? You would agree? Well, before the 1500s, in every culture in the world, the idea that somebody was meant to rule another human and some people were meant to be ruled and that was totally okay, that was good. In fact, if you didn't do that in places like the Greco-Roman Empire, you actually weren't living into your purpose. So now we've wiped out anybody who lived before the 1500s. Heaven's real estate values have plummeted in the last 5 minutes. There's lots of room, apparently, lots of capacity. See, good is not a great standard. And look, it's not just with things like that. Like, there are things you believe now at your age that are good that when your mom tried to tell you they were good at 17, you were like, no, right? You've changed. And here's the other problem with good. How good? Like, when do they start keeping track? Does it start at Hudson's age? Or does it start somewhere around 12 or maybe 50 for some of us? We're hopeful, like let all those teenage and young adult years go. When do they start counting what's good? And how does the whole like formula work? If I got to have more good than bad, is it like exercise and calories? Like, you know, I drink a Coca-Cola, that's 150 calories. I got to walk at a brisk pace for 20 minutes, I'm told, to even that out. Is it the same? Like, if you're mean to the customer service person on the phone, what do you have to do to balance it? And how about this? How much time do you have? How do you know when you're almost out of time? And like, should we be speeding up at the end of our life? Or what if you were one of those kids and you were like rebellious all the time? Every rule was broken. You were just one of those. And we all know you're going to turn out fine later, but you had a really rough start. What if you end too soon and you're trying to be good now and you're just being good for nothing because you're not going to catch up? See, good is not a good standard when we're talking about heaven. And everybody believes that there's some formula that people who are more moral than me should go. In fact, we also always draw the line of good kind of right beneath us. Because you're great, great humans, aren't you? I mean, I know you are. Some of you are really. And all of you are thinking, I may not be good, but I'm gooder than him. I get that's not good grammar, right? We all have that. So what do we do about this? A friend of mine used to say, close enough is good enough. And my wife hates that phrase. And so does his wife, because like when he was putting together a table or building a deck, it was like, close enough is good enough. And it's not. It's just really not. But let's just say for a moment that we could be so good, we could be like 99.9% good. Would that be good enough? That sounds kind of fair, right? God should certainly allow someone who's 99.9% good in, don't you think? If we applied that to the rest of life, let me just show you a couple statistics. If 99.9% was good enough, the IRS would lose 2 million documents this year. Some of you, or somebody last night said, that would be an improvement. 22,000 checks would be deducted from the wrong account if 99.9 was good enough. 12 babies given to the wrong parent every day. Brandon, you're about to have a baby. Can you imagine? Not good. But it's 99% good. 20,000 incorrect prescriptions and 22 commercial airline flights would crash in the U.S. every day. I'm getting on a flight in like 3 hours. I don't like this definition of 99.9%, right? So what do we do? How do we deal with the fact that good just doesn't seem to be good enough? How do we deal with the dilemma? Three ways, major kind of philosophical, theological ways over time that people have dealt with it. And there's these three words, and you'll be able, I'm going to explain them as we go, but you've heard them before. These three words are this: pluralism, exclusivism, and inclusivism. And I'd say, oh my, that's a lot of isms. Here's what pluralism is. Pluralism is the idea that because we don't have this like clear across every culture, across every person standard, that ultimately probably every religion is fine. Just do it well, and they all lead to the same place. I mean, it's kind of like no one can have all the truth, right? So maybe you got a little bit, and the Muslims have a little bit, and the pantheists have a little bit, and we all have a part of the truth, but ultimately, everybody gets in, right? The problem is when you start actually playing that out, and you realize that there are strongly, deeply held beliefs by people in different religions like that that contradict each other. That they can't both be true. They can't all be mutually acceptable. Because there are things and there are reasons why I might choose to believe a certain thing, and yet it would actually be me doing evil to someone with a different take. Like here's a good example. If you live in a traditional culture, right, where the idea of marriage is all about the happiness of the family, keeping the family's honor and reputation in check, then if you're making laws, you make it really, really difficult to get divorced. But if you live in a more progressive culture that prizes the happiness of the individual, then you make divorce laws really, really easy, because the worst thing to do would be to keep someone from being happy. Do you see how these things can't work together in one system? So pluralism, I would say, for a bunch of other reasons too, it doesn't work. So then we have exclusivism. And I could even say that with like a, you know, ominous tone, exclusivism. Because today in 2024, nobody wants anything to be exclusive, unless you're getting like an exclusive sale invitation, you know? But exclusivity just sounds so wrong. Sounds so old-fashioned. The scripture, the Bible, Jesus himself, makes some claims about who gets in to heaven, and they're exclusive claims. Christianity is an exclusive religion. I want to show you that for the next few minutes, but then I want to show you the good God behind it as well. In an exclusivist worldview like Christianity, we would say that there is no salvation. There's no hope of heaven. There's no rescue apart from Christ. He's the only way in. And Jesus said some things that kind of sounded like that. Like one time, John 14, he said, "I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody comes to God except through me." Pretty exclusive claim. The writers of the scriptures would say that there is no way outside of him that we can ever find reconnection to God. We're all in some way broken, a word that nobody likes to use anymore either, sinners. Like sin, the evil power in the world to thwart God's plan and the evil stuff we do, that we're all that. So we're all on this kind of runaway train towards an eternity without God. And that Jesus says the only way out of that is through me. It's pretty exclusive. And it gets even more so because we feel like that kind of becomes arrogant when somebody says that belief, right? You've heard this before. Oh, you think that your way is the only right way? That's the most prideful sounding thing. Out of all of the religions in the world, you believe that your way is it? But can I tell you something? And you know this. If you had a terminal illness, you don't want a doctor to say, like, you know, you can do anything from Advil to chemo. All of it works fine. You want someone to say, no, this is exclusively the treatment. We would never judge someone prideful for choosing the one way to deal with the disease that they have. That's just called wisdom. And yet somehow when it comes to religion, we struggle with this idea. So Jesus says that it's exclusive. Peter, who wrote in Acts 4, in his first kind of big sermon he gave to people, Jesus is crucified and then resurrected, and he's gathered with all these Jews and all the people, and they're like, what in the world just happened? And Peter's trying to explain it, and he's not like so nice. He's pretty direct, and he says, like, he was God, you killed him, say you're sorry. And repent. And he says this in Acts 4:12, salvation is found in no one else. That's an exclusive claim. For there is no other name under heaven given to mankind by which we must be saved. That's it. And the people didn't like it. I mean, some of the people who were there that day turned and said, all right, well, then I'm in. I'm with the guy who predicted his own death and then pulled it off, his resurrection. I'm in. But many didn't. And some of us don't like that idea. Because some of us don't understand it. Like, God, why did you have to choose this way? Why is it only belief in Jesus? I don't get it. A few years ago, Jessica and I bought a house. And the people that lived there before us had redone the kitchen. And it was really nice. And one of the things they did is they put this really nice microwave in there that could do all kinds. It was a microwave, but it could do like everything, you know, convection. And I don't know what all the terms are, but it did a lot of stuff. But it had a built-in area, so only that microwave could fit. And about a week before the warranty went out, thankfully, the microwave just quit. It quit working. Now, that doesn't sound like maybe such a terrible thing to you, but if you're like me and you can only cook with a microwave, that's problematic. And so there was no fixing it. You know, talk to a repairman. You can't fix it. It's just got to be replaced. So call the GE customer service people. And because we're proactive, like, get it done people, like, my wife had already gone and bought a new microwave. Same one. And so she's calling to say, like, hey, I got the new microwave. Can you just send me a refund? So this lovely young lady on the other end of the phone line, who had all the power in the world because she was the customer service agent, said, that's not how it works. Any of you ever tried this before? She's like, what you have to do is we need you to take the receipt, the original paper receipt, and you need to, like, tape it to a sheet of paper. This is 2020. Like, tape it to the paper and mail it in through us, and we'll get it. We'll open up a file, and then we'll send you a certificate. You can go and buy your new microwave, and everything will be fine. And we're like, this is 2020? That's dumb. We already got the thing. Just send us the money. And in the most polite way that that lovely young customer service representative at GE could say, it was like, I don't care what you think. This is the process. This is how it works. So we didn't get a refund on the microwave. Some of us approach God that way about this question. God, I don't like your rules. I don't like the fact that it seems as if you move the goalposts because we can't really figure out how good is good, and we don't know when the race starts and stops. So I'm just going to do it my way. I'm just going to be as good as possible and work my way in. And it's kind of like him going, appreciate it, but that's not the way it works. See, the idea of works, of trying to be as good as you can to somehow earn your way in, is the biggest lie in human history. Martin Luther said it like this. He said that the most damnable and pernicious heresy that has ever plagued the mind of man is the idea that somehow he could make himself good enough to deserve to live with an all-holy God. If we think we can somehow rehabilitate, fix, remediate ourselves into goodness with God, we are mistaken. In fact, it reminded me of this scene, you know, at the concentration camp in Auschwitz. When you approach the gate, there's this sign over the top, and it is so haunting, and it's the biggest lie. And that, in German, that Arbeit macht frei means, does anybody know? Work makes free. So people got on trains and were shipped into this place, walking through thinking, if I just work long enough, if I just behave, I just do enough, I'll get set free on the other end. And everyone knows that what it led to was their death and destruction. Work does not make you free when it comes to Christ, when it comes to God in heaven. So what do we do? What does work then? How do we get there? If all the religions aren't it, and if there's an exclusive way through Christ, how do we do it? And I'm glad you asked, because it's Romans 10, 9 through 10. The most succinct, like I think, clear way to say this is this. Paul, who was really good, by the way, like good, good, kept all the rules. He was really good guy. He said later, once he realized what Christ had done, that everything in his life was like dirty, filthy rags. So he says, if you declare with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. You make it into heaven. For it's with your heart that you believe and are justified, and it's with your mouth that you profess your faith and are saved. So that sounds really simple. So I say a phrase, and then I believe that it's true, I'm in. Better than good, right? It's not exactly that simple. It is, but you gotta understand what these words and phrases mean, because what it sounds like to me is that I just recite some magic incantation and it's all taken care of. But let me break down what these phrases mean. First, declaring with your mouth Jesus is Lord. You get declare with your mouth. That means we publicly acknowledge. We say it in a way that people can hear it, in a way that the outside world can see it. And in this time, when Paul's writing in the Roman Empire, there was a phrase that citizens would have to speak. And the phrase was, Kaiser as Kyrios. Caesar is Lord. That would be the way that you would tell someone whenever you were approaching a government official. Once a year, they would have to come and proclaim this, Caesar is Lord. But it wasn't like you could just go, Caesar's Lord, and then do whatever you want. Like, you know, work with the Visigoths or the barbarians or whatever. There was a way of being a Roman citizen that followed your words. So when Paul says, folks, the way that you get is by declaring with your mouth, Jesus is Lord, he's doing two things. One is he's saying a direct affront to the empire itself. To go, you say that you have power over people. You claim exclusivity is the only way to live in this world. You say that this is the way to reach heaven. But I'm going to go with Jesus. I am taking the cultural, the momentary belief system, or the system of the nation that I live in, or the kingdom, and even though everything in it tells me this is how to find salvation, I'm going to say, no, I'm going with Christ. It's not just a magic phrase. It's an admission of submitting to the authority that's greater than you. Jesus is Lord. That Lord is like, he's your master. He's the one that gets to dictate what you do in your life, with your body, with your money, with your future. He gets all authority because he has all authority. That's what declaring with our mouth that Jesus is Lord means. And then he says, and you have to believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead. Now, why did he say that you have to believe that part, that God raised him from the dead? Why not that he was born of a virgin? Or that he was a carpenter in Nazareth, and that his tables were the best there was. Close enough was not good enough for Jesus, I guarantee it. Why this? Because what we're told is that the life and death and resurrection of Christ, God raising him from the dead, was the proof that what he had done atoned for all of our sin and all our failure. He made us good enough by living a perfect life. And he did it all the way. Not just all the right things, but he even did the right things for the right reasons. How many of us would get tripped up if our motives got checked, right? You're generous to somebody, but it's really because you want them to notice you, how generous you are, and get some reputational fame. Like, that doesn't count. That's not good enough. That's not 99.9% good enough. So Jesus does it perfect, and then he goes to a cross, and we're told that God accepted his death as the payment for all of our not good enough, and the receipt was his resurrection. That's how we know it worked. So it's not just like, oh yeah, I believe. It's, I am putting my trust, my weight on this fact. In fact, I know I'm not going to be good enough. So much so that I'm going to trust Jesus was in my place. Here's the thing that's kind of wild. Christians actually should expect that your other friends and neighbors who have different beliefs, they might be better people than we are. More moral people, gooder people. Because for that, it's up to them to do all the good, right things. And there's this freedom that we have that Christ has done it for me. How many of you feel really good about that sales pitch I just gave? Okay, there's one tiny little catch. In Matthew 7, Jesus said something that seems to, well, I'll let you hear it for yourself. Not everyone who says to me, this is Jesus speaking, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. But only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Okay, so time out. Paul, you said, just say he's Lord. Jesus says, you called me Lord and I'm not letting you in. And then he goes on and he says, many are going to tell me in that day, Lord, look at what we did. We cast out demons. We prophesied. We performed miracles. I mean, if we're keeping score on good, that's pretty good, right? I mean, you don't get much better than that. Casting out a demon? And he says, the problem was you did these things and you said the word, Lord, but you didn't know me. You don't have a relationship with me. You didn't let me into your life. You didn't make me master. You said, Lord, but then you relied on all your good stuff. And then it's haunting because he says, I'll tell them plainly, I never knew you apart from me. So even the people that do miracles aren't good enough? Like, what are we to do? Good enough depends on God's goodness, not yours. The only way through this dilemma is we trust that he was good enough, and his word is good enough, his promise is good enough, and then we live in freedom according to that, doing our best to live like a citizen, putting Jesus in charge of our transformation, our discipleship, our life, and we say, I'm all in. That's who goes to heaven. And it brings up a question, because I know what you're thinking is like, okay, fine, now maybe we're good. But what about all the people that don't know this, Jason? There are people that live in the Amazon rainforest in tribes that have never heard this before. Are you telling me they don't get in? Is that fair? Or a 12-year-old Syrian girl who lives in a household where she's not allowed to read and she'll never hear the name of Jesus. She doesn't get in either. And this is where the third kind of worldview has come into play. And it's called inclusivism. And inclusivism says, okay, Jesus is the only way, but anybody who doesn't know that just gets a free pass. And so I just want to tell you, like, we have to be careful with that. Because I think what we're saying is, God, that's unfair. I don't like your process. I have a better one. I buy the microwave, you send me the money. In Psalm 19, we read just a couple weeks ago, at the beginning, it says the heavens declare the glory of God. That all of us, there's a part of what it means to be human, that when you, anybody see the sunrise on Thursday morning this week? Oh my gosh. That the heavens are screaming out, God is here and he's good and we should say thank you. And it says that every person who's ever lived has known that. Romans 1, Paul would say it this way, that the divine nature and the eternal attributes of God, just how good he is, have been made clear through nature. And you know it, and I know it, and we have no excuse not to give him back the worship he deserves for that. And here's what I know, that God gives light to every person enough, and those who choose to respond to the light he gives more light to. Let me give you an example. In Acts 10, Peter, that same guy who said the salvation by no other name, he goes to this guy named Cornelius. Like, God speaks to him and says, you go talk to this man. Cornelius is an enemy. He's a Roman. But Cornelius is a really, like, devout guy. He's seeking truth. We read that he's, like, trying to find the real answer. He's pushing back against the culture, and he wants to know God, but he's never heard this story. And Peter shows up and says, Cornelius, let me tell you about Jesus, his life, death, and resurrection, and Cornelius believes it. And it happened because his response to the light God gave him, God turned into more. That's just one Bible example. Let me give you one from my life. Several years ago, Jessica and I used to work in inner Senegal in a mission there, working with villages to try to help them to find flourishing. And it was everything from building a church to digging a water well to providing microeconomy, microfinance. And the first time I went, I'm sitting in this remote village and I'm talking to a guy. His name is Sadu Kama. Sadu speaks a language called Wolof. It's a big tribal language in that part of the world. But the national language of Senegal is French. And he didn't speak French. And he's explaining to me, because I'm asking, like, why do you want Christ here so much? He would take off every morning on his horse. He'd ride as far as he could go in one direction, telling everybody about Jesus that way, and then he would just, like, make a big circle until he got back home. And that was his life. I'm like, how did that happen? And Sadhu says, well, I always believed there was truth, and I wanted it, and I prayed for it. He grew up in a folk Islam where there's, like, sacrifices and kind of, like, tribal stuff. And he said, one day this man came through our village and he left a book. It was in a language that I don't understand, but I picked it up and somehow I could read it. And the book was the Gospel of John in French. He couldn't read French, But he responded to the light that God had given him, believing there was something to this God out there. And as he sought, God gave him more. He reads the book of John, realizes that Jesus says, "I am the way, truth, and life," and goes, "I want to know him." And I'm not kidding you. He told me that a man would show up at his house, at his hut, for weeks, saying it was Jesus and explained to him everything in the Bible. And I've heard that from people there and from a young lady in Cairo, Egypt. And some of you have stories like that. Folks, you don't have to try to defend God's fairness and justice. He will do what's right. He is that good. I know we want to worry about those who haven't heard. And maybe what that should make us do is kind of share our story. Maybe we should make sure that we tell people about this Christ. But you don't have to be afraid that God is going to treat someone unfairly, because he's just that good. At the end of the day, Christianity, while exclusive, became, well, Tim Keller says it like this, that the truth of Christianity is exclusive, but it's the most inclusive, exclusive truth in the world. And here's what it means. It doesn't matter your race, your ethnicity, your past history, your gender, the color of your skin, the language that you speak, what kind of culture you came from. Any and all are invited to walk through the door that Jesus said was himself and to experience heaven, to be rescued, to become and be made good enough because of what he's done. But you gotta choose. C.S. Lewis, in a really tough quote, so get ready. But he said it like this. There are only two kinds of people in the end. Those who say to God, "Your will be done," and those to whom God says, "Your will be done." If you want it your way, if you want to buy the microwave and not follow my your will be done. All that are in hell choose it. Without the self-choice, there could be no hell. No soul that seriously and constantly desires joy will miss it. Why? Because those who seek, find, and to those who knock, it is opened, and that's what Jesus said. And so I want to invite you today. I'm going to do something that's, well, it's clearly not very Presbyterian. But it's based on this good news. Here's the good news. That who gets to heaven is all about, it's all based on, it's dependent on God's goodness, not ours. And so now, unfortunately, I've told you this truth. So now you're responsible for it. And I don't think that we should leave today without you having the opportunity to respond to it. And so I'm not going to make you do something weird like throw sawdust down and have you walk forward or anything like that. I mean, that's fine. That works. But I just want to do this. I want to pray for you, and I want to ask that if you're like, if there's something in you that's like, I believe it. I believe in my heart. And I want to say Jesus is Lord. You may not even know everything that means for the rest of your life. That's okay. But if you're like, I want that to be true, then today's your day to respond. So I'm going to ask that everybody close their eyes. And as you close your eyes, if you're the one that I'm talking to, that God's speaking to, then in just a moment, I'm asking you to do something. For those of you that are followers of Jesus, you're in, then I want you to just pray for the people around you. So with your eyes closed, let me pray for you. Father, I ask that right now, seeds that were planted in hearts and in minds decades ago, in some cases, would in the next moment come to life. That knowledge that was put in, or stories about you, questions that we had that just never would let us go, God, I pray all of that would point to this moment, a new life would be birthed in people. Thank you that it is not about our goodness. It is all about yours. And so I ask that in that goodness right now, you would bring people to yourself. So here's what I'm going to ask. Everybody keep your eyes closed. And if you want to respond, you don't have to say it out loud at this moment, but I want to give you a chance for a milestone in your life. Would you that's what you want, would you just look up at the cross that's behind me? Just raise your eyes and just look at it. I'm so glad. Gosh, I'm so glad for you. I'm so grateful that you've chosen that. So God, you see not just the eyes, you see the hearts of people in this room. Would you be true to yourself that anyone who confesses you as Lord, sovereign, master, and believes that you're enough, that we will be saved. God, thank you for saving people today. Thank you for saving me. We ask now that you'd help us to follow you wherever you'll take us, that you might make us good, not just for our sake, but for a world that needs it. And we pray, Jesus, in your resurrected name.